Thank you, Lois. Thank you all for coming. I'm going to read three pieces to you tonight. First, a section from my novel, from the start of my novel, Going Blind, and then two short stories. The section from the novel has a reading time of about 10 minutes, and each of the short stories a little bit over 20 minutes. First, from the start of my novel, Going Blind. By now, my friend August was flat as a man of gingerbread, buckled at the knees and curled at the feet by too hot an oven, nibbled cruelly up and down his long limbs and sides. Apologizing for our lateness, Ruth bent down to him. Her right hand touched his cheek and neck, while her left caught up the brown black hair that fell swinging to shroud their kiss. A dark delta of damp, like the mark of a tongue, had stained the side of her sleeveless summer dress. August and I had become close friends in college. We had competed for the praise of professors, nervously shown each other our poems, often gotten drunk together, though alcohol turned him a steaming red. From graduate schools on opposite coasts, we had exchanged letters steadily. A year after he joined the State University's Manhattan branch, he helped me get a job there too. There I spent so much time with him and his wife, Ruth, that we were a threesome. And there we had been colleagues for years. Before the future seemed so clear, it was unmentionable. He would die. I would marry her. This prospect had brightened in a dawn so slow that I sometimes felt we had glimpsed it from the beginning. He had always had a way, once romantic, later frightening, of seeming likely to die soon. The least of complaints, down to sunburn and earache and insomnia, punished him more severely than anyone else. His aching teeth poisoned him. His colds became pneumonia. Cancer beat upon him gradually as a ship on the horizon that grows taller only after you have forgotten about it for a while. August had had vague stomach trouble for years, an ache, a stitch, spasmodic bowels. And then one day, Ruth told me, he just came out of the bathroom and said it had been bloody. She hunched her shoulders so that I wanted to wrap her like a child chilled in a wet swimsuit. Dark blood, she said, from high up. Sigmoidoscopy revealed a polyp. A nothing, said the surgeon, Feldman, who removed it. But not many months later, there were more polyps, and Feldman took out part of August's colon. I went to the hospital every day, then to the apartment when August came home, brought paperbacks and magazines that grew in stacks on his bedside table, brought quarts of rich ice cream the color of old ivory with mahogany swirls, though August never had more than a swallow or two. Ruth would slowly eat a dishful, and I would polish off the quart with a silver serving spoon. August returned to teaching and the book he was writing on plot in Dickens. Again, he and Ruth went to meetings of their Citizens Commission, attacking civic problems whose hopelessness paralyzed me. Fine fall weekend afternoons, the three of us walked in Central Park. At Christmas, they vacationed in Italy, at Easter, in San Francisco. I often imagined his dying far from home, and when my phone rang, I half believed that the voice would be Ruth's, fuzzy with distance. There would be calls to airline ticket offices, a taxi to the airport, and at last I would descend to where Ruth waited for me, alone. But it was more than a year later, and August was still feeling fine when Feldman's examination dictated more surgery. "This time should do it," he said. He removed what was left of August's large intestine. Through an off-center hole below the navel, he drew out the stub of the small intestine so that it emptied fecal matter into a plastic bag held on with glue and surgical tape. "Your longevity should now be unaffected," August quoted for us, giving the surgeon's phrases a rich juiciness. "Swimming? Skiing? Absolutely." August had never done either. "Everything should be normal, marital relations included." A ghastly smile crossed my friend's face. This time, when he came home from the hospital, he was so gaunt that his wedding ring slipped off and was lost. His appetite did not recover quickly. There were nights when I, sitting uncomfortably in his place at the blonde maple table, opposite Ruth's slim clasped hands and evasive eyes, stayed to eat the dinner that she had made for him. But again, stubborn as evolution, at first pale and perspiring, he got out of bed, to his feet, into clothes that sagged and flapped looser than ever, to the kitchen and his study and the classroom where he taught. We three again took our walks, those shorter and slower ones now. That Christmas, he and Ruth went to Japan with 5 days in Hawaii. Jogging through the snowy park, my breath smoking as though I were on fire inside, I thought of them, roomed in a high hotel, August resting on a bed, shirtless, while Ruth unpacked. The spring semester was hardly begun before he started feeling ill and weakened. The word metastasis was used. When Ruth asked about more surgery, Feldman only shrugged his mustache in a small smile of defeat and said softly, "There comes a point." Instead, he ordered chemotherapy and a course of radiation. "This will help him for a while," he told us. Weekend afternoons, while August dozed, Ruth still sometimes walked with me. There was no pleasure in Central Park, where he had stepped on the paths beside us, sat with us on the benches to rest and talk. Instead, near my apartment, west of Amsterdam Avenue on 123rd Street, we walked the west side. Along Amsterdam sometimes, on sidewalks patched with litter and glittering with smashed glass, across 125th Street and up the hill beyond, past the empty Department of Parks sheltering arms pool, which shimmered in summer with every human tint, on beyond the university's brownstone facades, past its attendant bookstores, the campus grill, as far as the Church of Believers in the Commandments of God, windows opaque with biblical texts in psychedelic colors. But farther north than that, it was unsafe to go, and a greener route became our usual one. We climbed my block to Broadway, turned left past Jewish Theological Seminary, crossed Broadway at 122nd, strolled west another block, and into Sakura Park. Here, Ruth would stop me to gaze at Butterfield, 1831-1901, who, with arms calmly folded, with scabbarded sword and brave mustache, told us that pain should be forgotten, like insects crawling upon one's plinth. Butterfield was twice my size and seemed still to be growing, his head in the leaves of the tree behind him. What did he care for Julio, puppet, sly 125, whose blue and orange scrawls smeared his military cloak? He would be watching over tree-shaded walks and marble benches when they were fallen to mold. We walked on, across Riverside Drive and into Riverside Park. At Grant's tomb, on a cement bench inlaid with bright mosaic swirls, we rested and watched camera-dangling visitors come and go in busloads. A pushcart vendor sold us giant pretzels. Walking slowly now, we headed north, past children swarming at too few swings and benches full of motionless grandparents, to the grave of the amiable child. Died in the fifth year of his age, Ruth read, bending close to the little plaque, holding back her tumbling hair, removing her sunglasses, replacing them. There was a fine view of the Jersey shore, where shining apartment towers soared from the steep wooded bank. Upriver, the George Washington Bridge hung loops of silver in the declining sun.